Kate reached his seat in the center of the table, in front of the American flag. He spotted Scott for the first time and nodded in acknowledgement of his presence. Once everyone was settled, the Secretary of State opened the meeting with a predictably banal speech of welcome, most of which could have been used for anyone from Yeltsin to Mitterrand. The Prime Minister of Israel responded in kind. Then, for the next hour, they discussed the problems of the Middle East, and Scott could find few differences other than those of emphasis between the two men and their predecessors. Both were perhaps a tiny bit more conciliatory, but still every bit as cautious as Shamir and Baker had been before them. During the second hour, Scott began to wonder why they had dragged him away from Yale when any decent CIA Middle East operative could have handled this particular meeting. It was during any other business that Rabin raised the subject no one had anticipated. The Prime Minister circled around the problem for a few minutes, but Scott could see exactly where he was heading. Christopher was obviously being given the opportunity, if he wanted it, to kill any discussion stone dead before Rabin raised it officially. Scott scribbled a note on a piece of paper and passed it over to Susan. She read his words, nodded, leaned across, and placed the note on the blotting pad in front of the Secretary of State. He unfolded the single sheet, glanced at the contents, but showed no sign of surprise. Scott assumed that Christopher had also worked out the size of the bombshell that was about to be dropped. The Prime Minister had switched the discussion to the role of Israel in relation to Iraq, and reminded the Secretary of State three times that they had gone along with the Allied policy on Operation Desert Storm when it was Tel Aviv and Haifa that were being hit by Scuds, not New York or Little Rock. It amused Scott that at the last meeting Rabin had said New York or Kennebunkport. He went on to say he had every reason to believe that Saddam was once again developing a nuclear weapon, and Tel Aviv and Haifa still had to be the first candidates for any warhead. "Try not to forget, Mr. Secretary, that we've already had to take out their nuclear reactors once in the past decade," the Prime Minister said. "And if necessary, we'll do so again." Christopher nodded but made no comment. "And were the Iraqis to succeed in developing a nuclear weapon," continued Rabin, "no amount of compensation or sympathy would help us this time. And I'm not willing to risk the consequences of that happening to the Israeli people while I'm Prime Minister." Christopher still offered no opinion. "For over 2 years since the Gulf War ended, we have waited for the downfall of Saddam Hussein, either at the hands of his own people or at least by some outside influence encouraged by you. As each month goes by, the Israeli people are increasingly wondering if Operation Desert Storm was ever a victory in the first place." Christopher still didn't interrupt the Israeli Prime Minister's flow. "The Israeli government feels it has waited long enough for others to finish the job." He paused to allow the implications of his statement to sink in. "We have therefore prepared a plan to assassinate Saddam Hussein. We have at last discovered a way of breaching Saddam's security and even possibly of being invited into his bunker. Even so, this will still be a more difficult operation than those which led to the capture of Eichmann and the rescue of hostages at Entebbe." The Secretary of State looked up. "And are you willing to share this knowledge with us?" he asked quietly. Scott knew what the reply would be even before the Prime Minister spoke, and so, he suspected, did Christopher.
"No, sir, I am not," replied Rabin, looking down at the page in front of him. "The only purpose of my statement is to ensure we do not clash with your colleagues from the CIA, since we have information which suggests that they are currently considering such a plan themselves."
Dexter Hutchins thumped his knee with a clenched fist. Scott hastily wrote a two-word note and passed it across to Susan. She removed her glasses, read the message, and looked back at him. Scott nodded firmly, so she once again leaned forward and placed the note in front of the Secretary of State. He glanced at Scott's words, and this time he reacted immediately.
"We have no such plan," said Christopher. "I can assure you, Prime Minister, that your information is not correct.
Rabin looked surprised. And may I add that we naturally hope you will not consider any such action yourselves without keeping President Clinton fully informed. It was the first time the president's name had been brought into play, and Scott admired the way the Secretary of State had applied pressure without any suggestion of a threat. I hear your request, replied the Prime Minister. But I must tell you, sir, that if Saddam is allowed to continue developing his nuclear arsenal, I cannot expect my people to sit by and watch. Christopher had reached the compromise he needed, and perhaps even gained a little time. For the next 20 minutes, the Secretary of State tried to steer the conversation onto more friendly territory, but everyone in that room knew that once their guests had departed, only one subject would come under discussion. When the meeting was concluded, the Secretary instructed his own staff to wait in the conference room while he accompanied the Prime Minister to his limousine. He returned a few minutes later with only one question for Scott. How can you be so sure Rabin was bluffing when he suggested we were also preparing a plan to eliminate Saddam? I watched his eyes and he gave away nothing, said Christopher. I agree, sir, replied Scott. But it was the one sentence he delivered in 2 hours that he read word for word. I don't even think he had written it himself. Some advisor had prepared the statement, and more important, Rabin didn't believe it. Do you believe the Israelis have a plan to assassinate Saddam Hussein? Yes, I do, said Scott. And what's more, despite what Rabin says about restraining his people, I suspect it was his idea in the first place. I think he knows every detail, including the likely date and place. Do you have any theories on how they might go about it? No, sir. I don't, replied Scott. Christopher turned to Susan. I want to meet with Ed Derigian and his senior Mideastern people in my office in 1 hour, and I must see the president before he departs for Houston. Christopher turned to leave, but as he reached the door, he glanced back. Thank you, Scott. I'm glad you were able to get away from Yale. It looks as if we're going to be seeing a lot more of you over the next few weeks. The Secretary of State disappeared out of the room. May I add my thanks, too? Said Susan as she gathered up her papers and scurried after her boss. My pleasure, said Scott, before adding, Care to join me for dinner tonight? Jockey Club? 8 o'clock? Susan stopped in her tracks. You must do your research more thoroughly, Professor Bradley. I've been living with the same man for the past 6 years, and I heard it wasn't going that well lately, interjected Scott. In any case, he's away at a conference in Seattle, isn't he? She scribbled a note and passed it over to Dexter Hutchins. Dexter read the 2 words and laughed before passing it on to Scott. He's bluffing. When the two of them had been left alone, Dexter Hutchins also had one question that he needed answered. How could you be so sure that we aren't planning to take Saddam out? I'm not, admitted Scott. But I'm certain that the Israelis don't have any information to suggest we are. Dexter smiled and said, Thanks for coming down from Connecticut, Scott. I'll be in touch. I've got a hunch the plane to Washington is going to feel like a shuttle for you over the next few months. Scott nodded, relieved that the term was just about to end and no one would expect to see him around for several weeks. Scott took a cab back to the Ritz-Carlton, returned to his room, and began to pack his overnight case. During the past year, he'd considered 100 ways that the Israelis might plan to assassinate Saddam Hussein. But all of them had flaws because of the massive protection that always surrounded the Iraqi president wherever he went. Scott felt certain also that Prime Minister Rabin would never sanction such an operation unless there was a good chance that his operatives would get home alive. Israel didn't need that sort of humiliation on top of all its other problems. Scott flicked on the evening news. The president was heading to Houston to carry out a fundraiser for Senator Kruger before the special May elections. His plane had been late taking off from Andrews. There was no explanation as to why he was running behind schedule. The new president was quickly gaining a reputation for working by Clinton standard time. All the White House correspondent was willing to say was that he had been locked in talks with the Secretary of State. Scott switched off the news and checked his watch. It was a little after 7, and his flight wasn't scheduled until 9:40. just enough time to grab a bite before he left for the airport. He'd only been offered sandwiches and a glass of milk all day and figured that the CIA at least owed him a decent meal. Scott went downstairs to the jockey club and was taken to a seat in the corner. A noisy congressman was telling a blonde half his age that the president had been locked in a meeting with Warren Christopher because they were discussing my amendment to the defense budget. The blonde looked suitably impressed, even if the maitre d' didn't. Scott ordered the smoked salmon, a sirloin steak, and a half bottle of Mouton Cadet before once again going over everything the Israeli prime minister had said at the meeting. But he concluded that the shrewd politician had given no clues as to how or when or even whether the Israelis would carry out their threat. On the recommendation of the maitre d', he agreed to try the house special, a chocolate soufflé. He convinced himself that he wasn't going to be fed like this again for some time, and, in any case, he could work it off in the gym the next day. When he'd finished the last mouthful, Scott checked his watch, 8:03. Just enough time for coffee before grabbing a taxi to the airport. Scott decided against a second cup, raised his hand, and scribbled in the air to indicate that he'd like the check. When the maitre d' returned, he had his MasterCard ready. "Your guest has just arrived," said the maitre d', without indicating the slightest surprise.
"My guest?" began Scott.
"Hello, Scott. I'm sorry I'm a little late, but the president just went on and on asking questions."
Scott stood up and slipped his MasterCard back into his pocket before kissing Susan on the cheek.
"You did say 8:00, didn't you?" she asked.
"Yes, I did," said Scott, as if he had simply been waiting for her. The maitre d' reappeared with two large menus and handed them to her customers.
"I can recommend the smoked salmon and the steak," she said, without even a flicker of a smile.
"No, that sounds a bit too much for me," said Susan. "But don't let me stop you, Scott."
"No, President Clinton's not the only one dieting," said Scott. "The consommé and the house salad will suit me just fine."
Scott looked at Susan as she studied the menu, her glasses propped on the end of her nose. She had changed from her well-cut dark blue suit into a calf-length pink dress that emphasized her slim figure even more. Her blonde hair now fell loosely onto her shoulders, and for the first time in his memory, she was wearing lipstick. She looked up and smiled.
"I'll have the crab cakes," she told the maitre d'.
"What did the president have to say?" asked Scott, as if they were still in a State Department briefing.
"Not a lot," she said, lowering her voice. "Except that if Saddam were to be assassinated, he feels that he would automatically become the Iraqis' number one target."
"A human enough response," suggested Scott.
"Let's not talk politics," said Susan. "Let's talk about more interesting things. Why do you feel Cizeri is underestimated and Bellini overestimated?" she inquired.
Scott realized Susan must have also read his internal file from cover to cover.
"So that's why you came. You're an art freak."
For the next hour, they discussed Bellini, Cizeri, Caravaggio, Florence, and Venice, which kept them fully occupied until the maitre d' reappeared by their side. She recommended the chocolate soufflé and seemed disappointed that they both rejected the suggestion. Over coffee, Scott told his guest about his life at Yale, and Susan admitted that she sometimes regretted she hadn't taken up an offer to teach at Stanford. "One of the five universities you've honored with your scholarship."
"But never Yale, Professor Bradley," she said before folding her napkin.
Scott smiled.
"Thank you for a lovely evening," she added, as the maitre d' returned with the check.
Scott signed it quickly, hoping she couldn't see and that the CIA accounts department wouldn't query why it was a bill for three people. When Susan went to the ladies' room, Scott checked his watch, 10:25. The last plane had taken off nearly an hour before. He walked down to the front desk and asked if they could book him in for another night. The receptionist pressed a few keys on the computer, studied the result, and said, "Yes, that will be fine, Professor Bradley. Continental breakfast at 7, and the Washington Post as usual."
"Thank you," he said, as Susan reappeared by his side. She linked her arm in his as they walked towards the taxis parked in the cobblestone driveway.
The doorman opened the back door of the first taxi as Scott once again kissed Susan on the cheek. "See you soon, I hope."
"That will depend on the Secretary of State," said Susan with a grin as she stepped into the back of the taxi.
The doorman closed the door behind her, and Scott waved as the car disappeared down Massachusetts Avenue. Scott took a deep breath of Washington air and felt that after two meals, a walk around the block wouldn't do him any harm. His mind switched constantly between Saddam and Susan, neither of whom he felt he had the full measure of. He strolled back into the Ritz-Carlton about 20 minutes later, but before going up to his room, he returned to the restaurant and handed the maitre d' a $20 bill.
"Thank you, sir," she said. "I hope you enjoyed both meals."
"If you ever need a day job," Scott said, "I know an outfit in Virginia that could make good use of your particular talents."
The maitre d' bowed.
Scott left the restaurant, took the elevator to the fifth floor, and strolled down the corridor to room 505. When he removed his key from the lock and pushed the door open, he was surprised to find he'd left a light on. He took his jacket off and walked down the short passageway into the bedroom. He stopped and stared at the sight that met him. Susan was sitting up in bed in a rather sheer negligee, reading his notes on the afternoon's meeting, her glasses propped on the end of her nose. She looked up and gave Scott a disarming smile.
"The Secretary of State told me that I was to find out as much as I possibly could about you before our next meeting."
"When's your next meeting?"
"Tomorrow morning, 9 sharp.
Chapter 8. Button Gwinnett was proving to be a problem. The writing was spidery and small, and the G sloped forward. It was several hours before Dollar Bill was willing to transfer the signature onto the two remaining parchments. In the days that followed, he used 56 different shades of ink and subtle changes of pressure on the dozen nibs he tried out before he felt happy with Lewis Morris, Abraham Clark, Richard Stockton, and Caesar Rodney. But he felt his masterpiece was undoubtedly John Hancock in size, accuracy, shade, and pressure. The Irishman completed 2 copies of the Declaration of Independence 48 days after he had accepted a drink from Angelo Santini at a downtown bar in San Francisco. "One is a perfect copy," he told Angelo, "while the other has a tiny flaw." Angelo stood looking at the 2 documents in amazement, unable to think of the words that would adequately express his admiration. "When William J. Stone was asked to make a copy back in 1820, it took him nearly 3 years," said Dollar Bill. "And more important, he had the blessing of Congress." "Are you going to tell me the one difference between the final copy you've chosen and the original?"
"No, but I will tell you it was William J. Stone who pointed me in the right direction."
"So what's next?" asked Angelo.
"Patience," said the craftsman, "because our little souffle needs time to rise."
Angelo watched as Dollar Bill transferred the 2 parchments carefully onto a table in the center of the room, where he had rigged up a water-cooled xenon lamp.
"This gives out a light similar to daylight, but of much greater intensity," he explained.
He flicked the switch on, and the room lit up like a television studio.
"If I've got my calculations right," said Bill, "that should achieve in 30 hours what nature took over 200 years to do for the original."
He smiled.
"Certainly enough time to get drunk."
"Not yet," said Angelo, hesitating. "Mr. Cavalli has one more request."
"And what might that be?"
asked Dollar Bill in his warm Irish brogue. He listened to Mr. Cavalli's latest whim with interest.
"I feel I ought to be paid double under the circumstances," was the forger's only response.
"Mr. Cavalli has agreed to pay you another $10,000, said Angelo. Dollar Bill looked down at the 2 copies, shrugged his shoulders, and nodded. 36 hours later, the chairman and the chief executive of Skills boarded a shuttle for Washington. They had 2 assessments to make before flying back to New York. If both proved positive, they could then arrange a meeting of the executive team they hoped would carry out the contract. If, however, they came away unconvinced, Cavalli would return to Wall Street and make two phone calls. One to Mr. Al-Obeidi, explaining why it would be impossible to fulfill his request, and the second to their contact in Lebanon, to tell him that they could not deal with a man who had demanded that 10% of the money be lodged in a Swiss bank account in his name. Cavalli would even supply the number of the account they had opened in Al-Obeidi's name in Geneva, and thus the blame for failure would be shifted from the Cavallis to the deputy ambassador from Iraq. When the two men stepped out of the main terminal, a car was waiting to ferry them into Washington. Crossing the 14th Street Bridge, they proceeded east on Constitution Avenue, where they were dropped outside the National Gallery, a building that neither of them had ever visited before. Once inside the East Wing, they took a seat on a little bench against the wall just below the vast Calder Mobile and waited. It was the clapping that first attracted their attention. When they looked up to see what was causing the commotion, they watched as flocks of tourists quickly stood to one side trying to make a clearing. When they saw him for the first time, the Cavallis automatically stood. A group of bodyguards, two of whom Antonio recognized, was leading the man through a human passage while he shook hands with as many people as possible. The chairman and the chief executive took a few paces forward to get a better view of what was taking place. It was remarkable. The broad smile, the gait and walk, even the same turn of the head. When he stopped in front of them and bent down to speak to a little boy for a moment, they might, if they hadn't known the truth, have believed it themselves. When the man reached the front of the building, the bodyguards led him towards the third limousine in a line of six. In moments he had been whisked away, the sound of sirens fading into the distance.
"That two-minute exercise cost us $100,000, said Tony as they made their way back towards the entrance.
As he pushed through the revolving door, a little boy rushed past him, shouting at the top of his voice, "I've just seen the president! I've just seen the president!"
"Worth every penny," said Tony's father. "Now all we need to know is whether Dollar Bill also lives up to his reputation."
Hannah received an urgent call asking her to attend a meeting at the embassy when there were still another 4 months of her course to complete. She assumed the worst. In the exams, which were conducted every other Friday, Hannah had consistently scored higher marks than the other five trainee agents who were still in London. She was damned if she was going to be told at this late stage that she wasn't up to it. The unscheduled appointment with the Counselor for Cultural Affairs, a euphemistic title for Colonel Kratz, Mossad's top man in London, was for 6 that evening. At her morning tutorial, Hannah failed to concentrate on the works of the Prophet Muhammad, and during the afternoon she had an even tougher time with the British occupation and mandate in Iraq, 1917-32. She was glad to escape at 5 o'clock without being assigned any extra work. The Israeli embassy had, for the past 2 months, been forbidden territory for all the trainee agents unless specifically invited. If you were summoned, you knew it was simply to collect your return ticket home. "We no longer have any use for you. Goodbye. And if you were lucky, thank you." Two of the trainees had already taken that route during the past month. Hannah had only seen the embassy once when she was driven quickly past it on her first day back in the capital. She wasn't even sure of its exact location. After consulting an A to Z map of London, she discovered it was in Palace Green, Kensington, slightly back from the road. Hannah stepped out of the South Kensington Underground station a few minutes before 6. She strolled up the wide sidewalk into Palace Green and on as far as the Philippine Embassy before turning back to reach the Israeli mission just before the appointed hour. She smiled at the policeman as she climbed the steps up to the front door. Hannah announced her name to the receptionist and explained she had an appointment with the Counselor for Cultural Affairs.
"Second floor. Once you reach the top of the stairs, it's the green door straight in front of you."
Hannah climbed the wide staircase slowly, trying to gather her thoughts. She felt a rush of apprehension as she knocked on the door. It was immediately opened, with a flourish.
"A pleasure to meet you, Hannah," said a young man she had never seen before. "My name is Kratz. Sorry to call you in at such short notice, but we have a problem. Please take a seat,"
he added, pointing to a comfortable chair on the other side of a large desk. Not a man given to small talk, was Hannah's first conclusion. Hannah sat bolt upright in the chair and stared at the man opposite her, who looked far too young to be the counselor for cultural affairs. But then she recalled the real reason for the colonel's posting to London. Kratz had a warm, open face, and if he hadn't been going prematurely bald at the front, he might even have been described as handsome. His massive hands rested on the desk in front of him as he looked across at Hannah. His eyes never left her, and she began to feel unnerved by such concentration. Hannah clenched her fist. If she was to be sent home, she would at least state her case, which she had already prepared and rehearsed. The counselor hesitated as if he were deciding how to express what needed to be said. Hannah wished he would get on with it. It was worse than waiting for the result of an exam you knew you had failed. "How are you settling in with the Rubins?" Kratz inquired. "Very well, thank you," said Hannah, without offering any details. She was determined not to hold him up from the real purpose of their meeting. "And how's the course working out?" Hannah nodded and shrugged her shoulders. "And are you looking forward to going back to Israel?" asked Kratz. "Only if I've got a worthwhile job to go back to," Hannah replied, annoyed that she had lowered her guard. She wished Kratz would look away for just a moment. "Well, it's possible you may not be going back to Israel," said Kratz. Hannah shifted her position in the chair. "At least not immediately," added Kratz. "Perhaps I ought to explain. Although you have 4 more months of your course to complete..." He opened a file that lay on the desk in front of him. "Your tutor has informed us that you are likely to perform better in the final exams than any of the other 5 remaining agents, as I'm sure you know." It was the first time she had ever been described as an agent. "We have already decided you will be part of the final team," Kratz said, as if anticipating her question. "But, as so often happens in our business, an opportunity has arisen which we feel you are the best qualified person to exploit at short notice." Hannah leaned forward in her chair. "But I thought I was being trained to go to Baghdad." "You are, and in good time you will go to Baghdad, but right now we want to drop you into a different enemy territory. No better way of finding out how you'll handle yourself under pressure." "Where do you have in mind?" asked Hannah, unable to disguise her delight.
"Paris."
"Paris?" repeated Hannah in disbelief.
"Yes. We have picked up information that the head of the Iraqi interest section has asked his government to supply him with a second secretary. The girl has been selected and will leave Baghdad for Paris in 10 days' time. If you are willing to take her place, she will never reach Charles de Gaulle Airport."
"But they'd know I was the wrong person within minutes."
"Unlikely,"
said Kratz, taking out a thicker file from a drawer of his desk and turning a few pages.
"The girl in question was educated at Putney High School and then went on to Durham University to study English, both on Iraqi government grants. She wanted to remain in England but was forced to return to Baghdad when student visas were rescinded just over 2 years ago."
"But her family?"
"Father was killed in the war with Iran, and the mother has gone to live with her sister just outside Karbala."
"Brothers and sisters?"
"A brother in the Republican Guard, no sisters. It's all in the file. You'll be given a few days to study the background before you have to make up your mind. Tel Aviv is convinced we've a good chance of dropping you in her place. Your detailed knowledge of Paris is an obvious bonus. We would only leave you there for 3 to 6 months at the most."
"And then?"
"Back to Israel in final preparation for Baghdad. By the way, if you decide to take on this assignment, our primary purpose is not to use you as a spy. We already have several agents in Paris. We simply want you to assimilate everything around you and get used to living with Arabs and thinking like them. You must not keep any records or even make notes. Commit everything to memory. You will be debriefed when we take you out. Never forget that your final assignment is far more important to the State of Israel than this could ever be." He smiled for the first time. "Perhaps you'd like a few days to think it over."
"No, thank you," said Hannah. This time it was Kratz who looked anxious. "I'm happy to take on the job, but I have a problem."
"What's that?" asked Kratz.
"I can't type, and certainly not in Arabic." The young man laughed. Then we'll have to lay on a crash course for you. You'd better leave the Rubins immediately and get yourself moved into the embassy by tomorrow night. They won't ask you for an explanation and don't offer any. Meanwhile, study this.
He passed over a manila folder with the name Karima Saib, written across the top in bold letters.
Within 10 days you must know its contents by heart. The knowledge you retain may keep you alive.
Kratz rose from his side of the desk and walked around to accompany Hannah to the door.
"Just one more thing," he said as he opened the door for her. "I believe this is yours."
The counselor for cultural affairs handed Hannah a small, battered suitcase. In a car on the way to Georgetown, Cavalli explained to his father that within 100 yards of the gallery, the sirens would have been turned off, and the limousines would peel away one after another as they reached the next 6 intersections, losing themselves in the normal morning traffic.
And the actor?
With his wig removed and wearing dark glasses, no one would give Lloyd Adams a second look. He'll be taking the Metroliner back to New York this afternoon.
Clever.
Once their license plates have been switched, the 6 limos will return to the city in a couple of days with their original New York plates.
You've done a highly professional job, said his father.
Yes, but that was only the dress rehearsal of a single scene. What we're planning in 5 weeks' time is to put on a 3-act opera with the whole of Washington as our invited audience.
Try not to forget that we're being paid $100 million for our troubles,
the old man reminded him.
If we deliver, it'll be good value for money, said Cavalli as the car drove past the Four Seasons Hotel. The chauffeur turned left down a wide street and came to a halt outside a quaint old wooden house. Angela was waiting by a little iron gate at the top of a small flight of stone steps. The chairman and chief executive got out of the car and followed Angelo down the steps at a brisk pace, without speaking. The door at the bottom was already open. Once they were inside, Angelo introduced them to Bill O'Reilly. Bill led them down the corridor to his room. When he reached the locked door, he turned the key as if they were about to enter Aladdin's cave. He opened the door and paused for just a moment before switching on the lights, then led his little party to the center of the room where the 2 manuscripts awaited their inspection. He explained to his visitors that only one was a perfect copy of the original. Bill passed both men a magnifying glass, then took a pace backwards to await their judgment. Tony and his father were not quite sure where to start and began studying both documents for several minutes without uttering a word. Tony took his time as he went over the opening paragraph.
When in the course of human events...
While his father became fascinated by the signatures of Francis Lightfoot Lee and Carter Braxton, whose colleagues from Virginia had left them so little room at the foot of the parchment to affix their names. After some time, Tony's father stood up to his full height, turned towards the little Irishman, and handed back the magnifying glass and said,
"Maestro, all I can say is that William J. Stone would have been proud to know you."
Dollar Bill bowed, acknowledging the ultimate forger's compliment.
"But which one is the perfect copy and which one has the mistake?"
asked Cavalli.
"Ah," said the forger, "it was also William J. Stone who pointed me in the right direction for solving that little conundrum."
The Cavallis waited patiently for Dollar Bill to continue his explanation.
"You see, when Timothy Matlock engrossed the original in 1776, he made 3 mistakes. 2 he was able to correct by simple insertions."
Dollar Bill pointed to the word "representative," where the letters E and N were missing, and then to the word "only," which had been omitted several lines further down. Both of the corrections had been inserted with a caret mark.
"But," continued Dollar Bill, "Mr. Matlock also made 1 spelling mistake, which he did not correct. On 1 of the copies, you will find I have."
Chapter 9. Hannah landed at Beirut Airport the night before she was due to fly back to Paris. No one from Mossad accompanied the new agent to avoid the risk of compromising her. Any Israeli found in Lebanon is automatically arrested on sight.
Anna had taken over an hour to be cleared by customs, but she finally emerged carrying a British passport, hand luggage, and a few Lebanese pounds. 20 minutes later, she booked herself into the airport Hilton. She explained to the receptionist that she would only be staying one night and paid her bill in advance with the Lebanese pounds. She went straight to her room on the 9th floor and did not venture out again that evening. She received just one phone call at 7:20. To Kratzer's question, she simply replied, "Yes," and the line went dead. She climbed into bed at 10:40 but couldn't sleep for more than an hour at a time. She occasionally flicked on the television to watch spaghetti westerns dubbed into Lebanese. In between, she managed to catch moments of restless sleep. She rose at 6:50 the following morning, ate a slab of chocolate she found in the tiny fridge, brushed her teeth, and took a cold shower. She dressed in clothes taken from her hand luggage of a type which the file had indicated Karima favored, and sat on the corner of the bed staring at herself in the mirror. She didn't like what she saw. Kratz had insisted that she crop her hair so that she looked like the one blurred photograph of Miss Saib they had in their possession. They also expected her to wear steel-rimmed spectacles, even if the glass in them didn't magnify. She'd worn the spectacles for the past week, but still hadn't got used to them, and often simply forgot to put them on, or, worse, mislaid them. At 8:19, she received a second phone call to let her know the plane had taken off from Amman with the cargo on board. When Hannah heard the morning cleaners chatting in the corridor a few moments later, she opened the door and quickly switched the sign on the knob outside to "Do Not Disturb." She waited impatiently in her room for a call saying either "Your baggage has been mislaid," which meant she was to return to London because they had failed to kidnap the girl, or "Your baggage has been retrieved," the code to show they had succeeded. If it was the second message, she was to leave the room immediately, take the hotel minibus to the airport, and go to the bookshop on the ground floor, where she was to browse until she was contacted. A courier would then arrive at Hannah's side and leave a small package containing Saib's passport with the photograph changed, the airline ticket in Saib's name, and any baggage tickets and personal items that had been found on her. Hannah was then to board the flight to Paris as quickly as possible, with only the one piece of hand luggage she had brought with her from London. Once she had landed at Charles de Gaulle, she was to pick up Karima Saib's luggage from the carousel and get herself to the VIP parking lot. She would be met by the Iraqi ambassador's chauffeur, who would take her to the Jordanian embassy, where the Iraqi interest section was currently located, the Iraqi embassy in Paris being officially closed. From that moment, Hannah would be on her own, and at all times she was to obey the instructions given by the embassy staff, particularly remembering that in direct contrast to Jewish women, Arab women were subservient to men. She must never contact the Israeli embassy or attempt to find out who any of the Mossad agents in Paris were. If it ever became necessary, one of their agents would contact her. "What do I do about clothes if Saib's don't fit?" she had asked Kratz. "We know I'm taller than she is." "You must carry enough in your overnight bag to last for the first few days," he had told her, "and then purchase what you will need for 6 months in Paris." 2,000 French francs had been supplied for this purpose. "It must be some time since you've been shopping in Paris," she had told him. "That's just about enough for a pair of jeans and a couple of T-shirts." Kratz had reluctantly handed over another 5,000 francs. At 9:27, the phone rang.
Honor Among Thieves, Cassette 3.
When Tony Cavalli and his father entered the boardroom, they took the remaining chairs at each end of the table, as the chairman and chief executive of any distinguished company might. Cavalli always used the oak-paneled room in the basement of his father's house on 75th Street for such meetings, but no one present believed they were there to conduct a normal board meeting. They knew there would be no agenda and no minutes. In front of each of the six places where the board members were seated was a notepad, pencil, and a glass of water, as there would have been at 1,000 such meetings across America that morning. But at this particular gathering, in front of every place, were also two long envelopes, one thin and one bulky, neither giving any clue as to its contents. Tony's eyes swept the faces of the men seated around the table. All of them had two things in common. They had reached the top of their professions, and they were willing to break the law. Two of them had served jail sentences, albeit some years before, while three of the others would have done so had they not been able to afford the finest lawyers available. The sixth was himself a lawyer. "Gentlemen," Cavalli began, "I've invited you to join me this evening to discuss a business proposition that might be described as a little unusual." He paused before continuing. "We have been requested by an interested party to steal the Declaration of Independence from the National Archives." Tony paused for a moment, as uproar broke out immediately, and the guests tried to outdo each other with one-liners. "Just roll it up and take it away. I suppose we could bribe every member of the staff. Set the White House on fire. That would at least cause a diversion. Write in and tell them that you won it on a game show." Tony was content to wait for his colleagues to run out of wisecracks before he spoke again. "Exactly my reaction when we were first approached," he admitted. "But after several weeks of research and preparation, I hope you will at least grant me an opportunity to present my case." They quickly came to order and began concentrating on Tony's every word, though skepticism would have best described the expression on their faces. "During the past weeks, my father and I have been working on a draft plan to steal the Declaration of Independence. We are now ready to share that knowledge with you because I must admit that we have reached a point where we can't advance further on this project without the professional abilities of everyone seated around this table. Let me assure you, gentlemen, that your selection has not been a random exercise. But first, I'd like you all to see the Declaration of Independence for yourself." Tony pressed a button underneath the table, and the doors behind him swung open. The butler entered the room carrying two thin sheets of glass, a parchment held between them. He placed a glass frame on the center of the table. The six skeptics leaned forward to study the masterpiece. It was several moments before anyone offered an opinion.
"Bill O'Reilly's work would be my guess," said Frank Piamonte, the lawyer, as he leaned over to admire the fine detail of the signatures below the text. "He once offered to pay me in forged bills, and I would have accepted if I'd got him off."
Tony nodded, and after they had all spent a little more time studying the parchment, he said, "So allow me to reword my earlier statement. We're not so much planning to steal the Declaration of Independence as to replace the original with this copy." A smile settled on the lips of two of the previously skeptical guests. "You will now be aware," said Tony, "of the amount of preparation that has gone into this exercise so far, and indeed the expense my father and I have been put to. But the reason we have continued is because we feel the rewards, if we are successful, far outweigh the risk of being caught. If you'll open the thin envelopes in front of you, I believe the contents will make my point more clearly. Inside each envelope, you will find a piece of paper on which is written the sum of money you will receive if you decide to become a member of the executive team." While the six men tore open the thinner of their two envelopes, Tony continued. "If you feel on discovering the amount involved that the reward does not warrant the risk, now's the time to leave. I trust that those of us who remain may have confidence in your discretion because, as you will be only too aware, our lives will be in your hands."
"And theirs in ours," said the chairman, speaking for the first time.
A ripple of nervous laughter broke out around the table as each of the six men eyed the unsigned check in front of him.
"That figure," said Tony, "is the payment you will receive should we fail. If we succeed, the amount will be tripled."
"So will the jail sentence if we get caught," said Bruno Morelli, speaking for the first time.
"Summing up, gentlemen," said Cavalli, ignoring the comment, "if you decide to join the executive team, you will receive 10% of that payment in advance when you leave tonight, and the remaining sum within 7 days of the contract being completed. This would be paid into any bank of your choice in any country of your choosing. Before you make your decision, there's one further thing I'd like you all to see.
Once again, Tony pressed a button under the table, and this time the doors opened at the far end of the room. The sight that greeted them caused two of the guests to immediately stand, one to gasp, and the remaining three to simply stare in disbelief.
"Gentlemen, I'm happy that you were able to join me today. I wanted to assure you all of my commitment to this project, and I hope you'll feel able to be part of the executive team. I'll have to leave you now, gentlemen,"
said the man standing next to the chairman in the Ozark accent that had become so familiar to the American people during the past few months,
"so that you can study Mr. Cavalli's proposition in greater detail. You can be assured that I'll do everything I can to help make the change this country needs, but for now, I have one or two pressing engagements. I feel sure you'll understand."
The actor smiled and shook hands warmly with everyone around the table before strolling out of the boardroom. Spontaneous applause broke out after the doors had closed behind him. Tony allowed himself a smile of satisfaction.
"Gentlemen, my father and I'll now leave you for a few minutes to consider your decision."
The chairman and chief executive rose without another word and left the room.
"What do you think?" asked Tony as he poured his father a whiskey and water from the cabinet in his study. "A lot of water," he replied. "I have a feeling we may be in for a long night."
"But did they buy it?"
"Can't be certain," replied the old man. "I was watching their faces while you were giving the presentation, and sure as hell, they didn't doubt the work you've put in. They were all impressed by the parchment and Lloyd Adams's performance, but other than Bruno and Frank, they didn't give much away."
"Let's start with Frank," said Tony.
"First in, then out, as Frank always is, but he likes money far too much to walk away from an offer as good as this."
"You're that confident," said Tony.
"It's not just the money," replied his father. "Frank's not going to have to be there on the day, is he? So he'll get his share whatever happens. I've never yet met a lawyer who would make a good field commander. They're too used to being paid whether they win or lose."
"If you're right, Al Calabrese may turn out to be the problem. He's got the most to lose."
"As our trade union leader, he'll certainly have to be out there on center stage most of the day, but I suspect he won't be able to resist the challenge."
"And what about Bruno, if..." began the chief executive, but he was cut short as the doors swung open and Al Calabrese walked into the room.
"We were just talking about you, Al. Not too politely, I hope."
"Well, it depends on,"
said Tony.
"On whether I'm in?"
"Or out,"
said the chairman.
"I'm in up to my neck," is the answer, said Al, smiling. "So you'd better have a foolproof plan to present to us."
He turned to face Tony, "because I don't want to spend the rest of my life as the man on top of America's most wanted list."
"And the others?"
asked the chairman, as Bruno Morelli brushed past them
without even saying good night.
Chapter 10. Hannah nervously grabbed the ringing phone.
"This is reception, madam. We were just wondering if you'll be checking out before midday, or do you require the room for an extra night?"
"No, thank you," said Hannah. "I'll have left by 12, one way or the other."
2 minutes later, the phone rang again. It was Colonel Kratz.
"Who were you speaking to a moment ago?"
"Reception was asking me when I would be checking out."
"I see," said Kratz. "Your baggage has been retrieved," was all he added.
Hannah replaced the phone and stood up. She felt a shot of adrenaline go through her body as she prepared for her first real test. She picked up her overnight bag and left the room, switching the sign on the door to "Clean me, please." Once she had reached the foyer, she had to wait only a few minutes before the hotel minibus returned from the airport on its circular journey. She sat alone in the back for the short trip to the departure area, then headed straight for the bookshop as instructed. She began to browse among the hardbacks, struck by how many American and British authors were obviously read by the Lebanese.
"Do you know where I can get some money changed, miss?"
Hannah turned to find a priest smiling at her who had spoken in Arabic with a slight mid-Atlantic accent. Hannah apologized and replied in Arabic that she didn't know where the currency exchange was, but perhaps the girl at the counter could help him. As she turned back, Hannah became aware of someone else standing by her side. He removed a copy of A Suitable Boy from the shelf and replaced it with a bulky package.
"Good luck,"
he whispered, and was gone, even before she had seen his face. Hannah removed the package from the shelf and strolled slowly out of the bookshop. She began to search for the check-in counter for Paris. It turned out to be the one with the longest line. When she reached the front, Hannah requested a non-smoking seat. The girl behind the counter checked her ticket and then began tapping away on her computer terminal. She looked puzzled.
"Were you unhappy with the seat previously allocated to you, Miss Sahib?"
"No, it's just fine," said Hannah, cursing herself for having made such a simple mistake. "Sorry to have bothered you."
"The flight will be boarding at gate 17 in about 15 minutes, the girl added with a smile.
A man pretending to read the Vikram Seth novel he had just purchased watched as the plane took off. Satisfied he had carried out his instructions, he went to the nearest phone booth and rang first Paris and then Colonel Kratz to confirm that the bird has flown. The man in the priest's surplice also watched Miss Sahib board her plane, and he too made a phone call. Not to Paris or London, but to Dexter Hutchins in Langley, Virginia. Cavalli and his father walked back into the room and once again resumed their places at each end of the table. One seat was empty.
"Too bad about Bruno," said the chairman, licking his lips. "We'll just have to find someone else to make the sword."
Cavalli opened one of the 6 files in front of him. It was marked Transport. He passed a copy to Al Calabrese.
"Let's start with the presidential motorcade, Al. I'm going to need at least 4 limos, 6 motorcycle cops, 2 or 3 staff cars, 2 vans with surveillance cameras, and a counter-assault team in a black Chevy Suburban. All of them able to pass the most eagle eye. I'll also want an additional van that would normally carry the White House media pool, the Death Watch. Don't forget the motorcade will be under far more scrutiny than last week, when we only had to turn on the sirens at the last moment, and then for just a few seconds. There's bound to be someone in the crowd who either works in government or is a White House junkie. It's often children who spot the most elementary mistakes, and then tell their parents."
Al Calabrese opened his file to find dozens of photographs of the president's motorcade leaving the White House on his way to the Hill. The photographs were accompanied by as many pages of notes.
"How long will it take you to have everything in place?" asked Cavalli.
3 weeks, maybe 4. I've got a couple of big ones in stock that would pass muster, and a bulletproof limo that the government often hires when minor heads of state are visiting the capital. I think the last crest we had to paint on a door was Uruguay. And the poor guy never even got to see the president. He ended up just getting 25 minutes with Warren Christopher. But now for the hard part, Al. I need 6 outriders, riding police motorcycles and all wearing the correct uniform.
Al paused.
That could take longer.
We haven't got any longer. A month's going to be the outside for all of us.
It's not that easy, Tony. I can't exactly put an ad in the Washington Post asking for police.
Yes, you can. In a moment, you'll all see why.
Most of you around this table must be wondering why we've been honored by the presence of Johnny Scaziatore, a man nominated for an Oscar for his direction of The Honest Lawyer.
What Cavalli didn't add was that since the police had found Johnny in bed with a 12-year-old girl, the studios hadn't been in touch quite as frequently as in the past.
"I was beginning to wonder myself," admitted Johnny. The chief executive smiled. "The truth is, you're the reason we'll be able to pull this whole plan off, because you're going to direct the entire operation."
"You're going to steal the Declaration of Independence and make a movie of it at the same time?" asked Johnny in disbelief.
Cavalli waited for the laughter that broke out around the table to die down. "Not exactly. But everyone in Washington on that day is going to believe that you are making a movie, not of us stealing the Declaration of Independence, but of the president visiting Congress. The fact that he drops into the National Archives on the way to the Capitol is something they won't ever need to know."
"I'm lost already," said Frank Piemonte, the team's lawyer.
Can you take it a little slower?
Sure, Frank, because this is where you come in. I need a city permit to close down the route between the White House and Congress for 1 hour on any day I choose in the last week in May. Deal direct with the city's motion picture and television office.
What reason do I give? Asked Piemonte.
That Johnny Scaziatore, the distinguished director, wants to film the President of the United States on his way to the House of Representatives to address a joint session of Congress.
Piemonte looked doubtful.
Clint Eastwood managed it last year, so there's no reason why you shouldn't.
Then you'd better put $250,000 into the Fraternal Order of Police, Lodge Number 1, suggested Piemonte. And the mayor will probably expect the same amount for her re-election fund.
You can bribe any city official, you know, continued Tony. And they also want every member of the city police force on our books squared for the day. All they have to believe is we're making a movie about the president.
Do you have any idea what mounting an operation like this is likely to cost? Asked Johnny Scaziatore.
Looking at the budget of your last film and the return we made on our investment, I'd say yes, replied Tony. And by the way, Al, he added, turning his attention back to the old Teamsters Union boss, 60 cops are due for retirement from the DCPD in April. You can employ as many of them as you need. Tell them it's a crowd scene and pay them double.
Al Calabrese added a note to his file. Now, the key to the operation's success, continued Tony, is the half block from the intersection of 7th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue to the delivery entrance of the National Archives. He unfolded a large map of Washington and placed it in the center of the table, then ran his finger along Constitution Avenue.
Once they leave you, Johnny, it's for real.
But how do we get in and out of the archives?
That's not your problem, Johnny. Your contribution ends when the 6 motorcycles and the presidential motorcade turn right onto 7th Street. From then on, it's up to Gino.
Until that moment, Gino Sartori, an ex-Marine who ran the best protection racket on the West Side, hadn't spoken. His lawyer had told him many times, "Don't speak unless I tell you to." His lawyer wasn't present, so he hadn't opened his mouth.
Gino, you're going to supply me with the heavy brigade. I need 8 Secret Service agents to act as the counter-assault team, preferably government-trained and well-educated. I only plan to be in the building for about 20 minutes, but we're going to have to be thinking on our feet for every second of that time. Debbie will continue to act as a secretary, and Angela will be dressed in naval uniform and carrying a small black case. I'll be there as the president's assistant, along with Dollar Bill as the president's physician.
His father looked up, frowning.
You're going to be inside the National Archives building when the document is switched?
Yes, replied Tony firmly. I'll be the only person who knows every part of the plan. And I'm sure not watching this one from the sidewalk.
A question, said Gino.
If, and I say only if, I am able to supply the 20 or so people you need, tell me this. When we reach the National Archives, are they just going to open the doors, invite us in, and then hand over the Declaration of Independence?
Something like that, replied Cavalli.
My father taught me that the successful conclusion of any enterprise is always in the preparation. I still have one more surprise for you.
Once again, he had their undivided attention.
We have our own special assistant to the president in the White House. His name is Rex Butterworth, and he's on temporary assignment from the Department of Commerce for 6 months.
He returns to his old job when the Clinton nominee has completed his contract in Little Rock and joins the president's staff. That's another reason why we have to go in May.
Convenient, said Frank.
Not particularly, said Cavalli. It turns out that the president has 46 special assistants at any one time. And when Clinton made his interest in commerce clear, Butterworth volunteered for the job. He's fixed a few overseas contracts for us in the past, but this will be the biggest thing he's done for us yet. For obvious reasons, it'll also have to be his last assignment.
Can he be trusted? Asked Frank.
He's been on the payroll for the last 15 years, and his third wife is proving rather expensive.
Show me one who isn't, said Al.
Butterworth's looking for a big payday to get himself out of trouble, and this is it.
And that brings me to you, Mr. Vicente, and your skills as one of the biggest tour operators in Manhattan.
That's the legit side of my business, replied the elderly man who sat on the right of the chairman, as befitted his oldest friend.
Not for what I have in mind, promised Tony. Once we have the declaration in our possession, we'll need it kept out of sight for a few days and then smuggled abroad.
As long as no one realizes it's been removed and I'm told well in advance where you want it delivered, that should be simple enough.
You'll get a week, said Cavalli.
I'd prefer two, said Vicente, raising an eyebrow.
No, Nick, you get a week, the chief executive repeated.
Can you give me a clue what distance it'll have to travel?
Vicente asked, turning the pages of the file Tony had passed across to him. Several thousand miles. And as far as you're concerned, it's COD, because if you fail to deliver, none of us gets paid.
That figures, but I'll still need to know how it has to be transported. For starters, will I have to keep the declaration between two sheets of glass the whole time?
I don't know myself yet, replied Cavalli. But I'm hoping you'll be able to roll it up and deposit it in a cylindrical tube of some kind. I'm having one specially made.
Does that explain why I've got several sheets of blank paper in my file? Asked Nick.
Yes, said Tony, except those sheets aren't paper but parchment, each one of them 29 3/4 inches by 24 1/4 inches, the exact size of the Declaration of Independence.
So now all I've got to hope is that every customs agent and Coast Guard patrol won't be looking for it.
I want you to assume the whole world will be looking for it, replied Cavalli. You aren't being paid this sort of money for doing a job I could handle with one called a Federal Express.
I thought you might say something like that, said Nick. Still, I had the same problem when you wanted the Vermeer of Rustboro stolen, and Irish customs still haven't worked out how I got the painting out of the country.
Cavalli smiled. So, now we all know what's expected of us. And I think in the future we should meet at least twice a week to start with, every Sunday at 3 o'clock and every Thursday at 6, to make sure none of us falls behind schedule. One person out of sync and nobody else will be able to move. Tony looked up and was greeted by nods of agreement. It always fascinated Cavalli that organized crime needed to be as efficiently run as any public company if it hoped to show a dividend. So we'll meet again next Thursday at 6. All five men nodded and made notes in their calendars. Gentlemen, you may now open the second of your two envelopes. Once again, the five men ripped open their envelopes and each pulled out a thick wad of $1,000 bills. The lawyer began to count each note.
Your down payment, Tony explained. Expenses will be met at the end of every week, receipts whenever possible. And Johnny, said Tony, turning to the director, this is not Heaven's Gate we're financing.
Scaziatore managed a smile.
Thank you, gentlemen, said Tony, rising. I look forward to seeing you all next Thursday at 6 o'clock.
The five men rose and made their way to the door, each stopping to shake hands with Tony's father before he left. Tony accompanied them to their cars. When the last one had been driven away, he returned to find his father had moved to the study and was toying with a whiskey while staring at the perfect copy of the declaration that Dollar Bill had intended to destroy. Chapter 11.
Calder Marshall, please.
The archivist can't be interrupted right now. He's in a meeting. May I ask who's calling?
It's Rex Butterworth, special assistant to the president. Perhaps the archivist would be kind enough to call me back when he's free. He'll find me at the White House.
Rex Butterworth put the phone down without waiting to hear what usually happened once it was known the call had come from the White House.
Oh, I feel sure I can interrupt him, Mr. Butterworth. Can you hold on for a moment?
But that wasn't what Butterworth wanted.
No, the special assistant needed Calder Marshall to phone back himself, because once he had gone through the White House switchboard, Marshall would be hooked.